Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Andy Burnham pitched himself as an outsider, not in that sort of populist way of saying I'm against the elites, but I'm from another part of the UK which perfectly well understands the cost of living crisis. Give me a chance to do this nationally.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
When do you stop being a migrant? I've been here for over 55 years, you see. Being classed as an immigrant, asking for help, you are very hesitant.
A third of older Australians were born overseas, yet their experience of aged care can be vastly different than the rest of the population. Today we're going to hear more from that person, 82-year-old Chalani, and one of the advocates who gave evidence at a Senate inquiry yesterday. Then, the pair of union giants call time.
Sally McManus and Michelle O'Neill announced they'll step down as heads of the Australian Council of Trade Unions.
A familiar voice on this program, Michelle O'Neill, will be here to explain why. And One Nation leader Pauline Hanson has lost an appeal against a court ruling that found she racially discriminated against Green Senator Maureen Faruqi. We are also going to hear from Senator Faruqi. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, there is a fair bit of unavoidable politics coming out of Victoria today. We've got to start by acknowledging just what's happened there with Premier Jacinta Allen falling on her sword. All of this exactly 4 months out from a state election. Here is what Jacinta Allen had to say a little earlier on.
I am making this decision because it is the right thing by the Labor Party and by the Victorian people. I was prepared to put my record and my plan to a ballot of members, as our rules allow. I believe I would have won. But doing so this close to an election takes up valuable resources, including the most precious of one, time. More importantly, it puts the state in a position of uncertainty. That hurts the Victorian people, and I just won't do that. I'm proud to be Victoria's second female Premier, and there have absolutely been moments when it's been hard and it's been personal. But the chance to make a difference was worth it. And if you're a woman making your start in politics, let me say this to you today. Please don't look at what I have experienced this week and think, stuff that, I don't want to be involved. Look at the support I've experienced over my career and think, I can make a difference here too.
So before Ms. Allen announced her resignation ahead of this morning's caucus meeting, we actually spoke with fellow Victorian Federal National Senator Bridget McKenzie.
Look, I think the Labor Party in Victoria has got a really tough road to hoe in terms of convincing Victorians that they deserve to be re-elected. You don't have to go very far out of Melbourne to see the crumbling roads, the spiralling debt. Though Victorians have had enough, they are absolutely fed up with the chaos of the Labor government under Daniel Andrews, Jacinta Allen, and whoever comes out as Premier.
Now, it does sound like that chaos is continuing. Here is a little of what the ABC's Victorian state political reporter Richard Willingham told ABC News a moment ago.
We just heard quite a bit of yelling actually going in inside caucus then, and our sources just texted me saying the room's a mess. They're actually looking at electing an interim Labor leader while they sort this mess out. Now, that is quite a significant development. That could not be Jacinta Allen or Ben Carroll or Simon Kilkenny. It'll have to be someone else if there's multiple candidates. So this is the sort of nightmare scenario people were warning about, and it could come to fruition.
So dramatic developments at Victoria's Spring Street today. By the time you're listening to this, there'll probably be more developments. The latest is that an interim leader has been elected while the party continues to resolve its leadership issues. Plenty more coverage on this on Radio National Breakfast tomorrow and also on The Breakfast Wrap. But putting that to one side, I want to really start off with an interesting story, an insight that you might just miss today, given all the other headlines around, but one that you really shouldn't. A third of all Australians over the age of 65 were born overseas, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Yet their experience of aged care can be vastly different to the rest of the population. Chalani is an 82-year-old woman from Brisbane. She's an Australian citizen who migrated here from Sri Lanka more than 50 years ago.
When do you stop being a migrant? I've been here for over 55 years, you see. And I have no will to go back to Sri Lanka even for a visit anymore, because to me, this home. We migrated in 1969. We came here as permanent migrants. I think at that time they were winding down the White Australia policy. So I've lived here longer than I've lived in the country I was born in. Wow. And this is my home. It is my home and my children's home. You know, being classed as an immigrant, although you've lived here for 50 odd years, asking for help, you are very hesitant, you see. You don't know, because you don't want to be a burden on society. I think that is where my husband also didn't want to get any help, even when his cancer had metastasized. He was a very proud person, you see, in the sense, culturally, he didn't want other people helping him. And I desperately needed someone to come and at least do the laundry. Anyway, this particular lady came to interview my husband, and she was asking questions, and he felt it was very invasive. He got embarrassed. And then he suddenly got up and said, look, you can ask all these questions from my wife. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, we can't, you know, approve anything. We have got to question you. And of course, this lady said, I will come back in January. But, well, he passed away on the 19th of January in 2020. My husband could speak English. We could communicate with all that. But what happens to people who cannot? It's hard, I think, for a migrant sometimes, especially with all the noise that's going around at the moment. There are times I feel a bit threatened now, because there are mixed messages that is coming through about the White Australia policy being a monoculture. The other day I went to the doctor, and I was walking to get onto the lift. The lady stopped me and said, oh, so this is the color of the society that we are going to live in from now on. I was taken aback when she said this. I stopped and I said, excuse me, what do you mean by that? Then she said, oh, you speak English. I said, I speak English. I have been speaking English ever since I was born. That's my second language. Maybe with an accent. And then she said, where do you live? So I told her the suburb. And she said, well, why did you come here? Then I told her that my husband was invited to the country. So this was the first time that I was subjected to that. And I felt very, very uneasy.
And that is Chalani, an 82-year-old woman from Brisbane, talking to our producer, Katie McAllister, about some of the challenges that she and her late husband faced accessing aged care. A Senate inquiry has been looking into the operation of the new Support at Home program, and it has heard evidence from multicultural advocates critical of how inaccessible this program is, particularly for culturally and linguistically diverse people. Lisa Ward is one of the advocates who gave evidence yesterday. She is the CEO of the Ethnic Communities Council for Queensland, and after listening in to Chalani on Radio National Breakfast, she had this conversation with Sally.
Lisa, listening to Chalani there, are stories like that common?
Unfortunately, yes, they are. And thank you for having me on today. Really appreciate you focusing on this issue.
The program is supposed to be about centering the care of elderly people. Is it centered around individuals from multicultural backgrounds from what you're seeing?
I actually argue that it's even centred around individuals at all. At the moment, there's a huge amount of work going on you know, by providers to ensure that they're compliant, make sure they actually understand the system themselves, make sure that they've got a workforce, an engaging workforce to want to work in the sector, and ensuring they're financially sustainable, that I think actually the system is sitting in the centre of what we're doing and clients are at the back end. However, for our migrants and refugees, with the additional barriers of language, you know, health literacy, not having the trusted relationships and not being able to navigate the system, no, they certainly are not at the centre of the system.
How does the current initial aged care assessment work, and is the model appropriate for members of multicultural communities?
So the assessment process, as you know, is the gateway into aged care, and it's meant to understand a person's need and determine the level of support that they require. The challenge is that the assessment relies heavily on people being able to communicate their needs, understand complex questions and advocate for themselves. And just like Shalani mentioned there, you know, there's an awful lot of barriers for people from different backgrounds. And it might be, you know, culture, language, stigma and shame, migration experiences, family circumstances. And that all really influences what good care actually looks like. So, I mean, I can give you another example, actually. One of my team recently supported a Vietnamese couple into the system, and both went through the exact same assessment process. They did it together. And the wife openly described the support that she needed and was assessed as a level three. Her husband, a bit like Shalani's husband, had greater clinical needs. But throughout the assessment, he repeatedly said, I'm fine, I don't want to be a burden to anyone. And he really was quite proud and didn't want to appear weak. And because of that, he actually ended up being assessed as a level one. And it really wasn't that the assessment had been done badly. It was the exact same process and it produced two very different outcomes. Interpreter was available, so the issue wasn't language, and it was understanding really that they need to understand the person that was behind the words. But the consequence is services are providing, and my team was providing weeks worth of work to try and build trust with that family, because it chipped away at their trust in the system, impacts on the service providers as well. And they had to work with family, explaining the assessment outcome, coordinating interpreters, gathering a different additional information, and really advocating for reassessment. And none of that work is incidental. It's really for that family, that was the care that they needed.
Lisa Ward there, the CEO of the Ethnic Communities Council of Queensland. And earlier, you heard from Chalani, an 82-year-old Australian, originally from Sri Lanka. The heads of the Australian Council of Trade Unions, Sally McManus and Michelle O'Neill, they are pretty familiar features on a show like this, indeed across much of the Australian media. They've been leading the ACTU for the better part of a decade. That was until today. Overnight, they announced they were both stepping down, less than a year out from the organisation's 100th birthday. So this morning on Radio National Breakfast, we're able to speak to ACTU President Michelle O'Neill, and here is what Sally asked her first.
Why now?
It's the right time. We thought about this and we just think that it's time for renewal. The union movement is in good shape. We've seen changes in workers' rights that have made a big difference in workers' lives. We've seen the union movement starting to grow for the first time in decades. And next year will be the 100th anniversary of the ACTU. So we think it's time for a new leadership team to come in. We didn't want next year to be a nostalgic year. We thought it was really important that at the next Congress that new leaders could be looking to the future. And for all those reasons, we think now's the right time.
You're saying that there's been a slight uptick in union membership, but it's still historically very low. The figure's around 2024 at 13.1%. Why do you think that that number remains relatively or historically low?
It is lower than it's been historically, but that increase that happened, and we get these figures every 2 years, but that increase in the 2 years up to 24 was a 12.5% increase, which was the largest increase in two generations. And we see these figures now at the ACTU since then continuing to come through with our membership figures from affiliates. And the very good part of the news about that turnaround in figures was it was driven by young workers, younger workers seeing unions as relevant to them.
One of the controversies that's shaped your tenure was the Victorian branch of the CFMEU under the leadership of John Setker. The reverberation of that are still being felt, and the full extent of that is still not fully known. Do you see any hope the union can emerge from this turbulent period?
It's essential that it does, Sally, because workers who work in the construction industry around this country, by and large, hardworking, good people who work in tough and dangerous jobs, and they deserve a great union. They deserve a union that is completely free of any violence or corruption or organised crime. And so it is essential that change happens in this industry, because it's what's needed to be able to make sure that those jobs are safe and good jobs. It's a hard job. The administration's been in place for 2 years now in the CFMEU, but what we know is that organised crime, particularly in Victoria, has its teeth in this industry. And so it's essential that everything is done that is going to make a difference to get them out and to give people the chance to be able to have the sort of union and industry they deserve to have.
The fact that the CFMEU was able to go so far astray, is that a failure of the broader union movement? And how do you reflect on the economic and social cost to the people of Victoria, with estimates of up to $15 billion being lost in corruption under Big Build and other projects?
The way we look at this is that we know that when it became clear that action had to be taken, the ACTU leadership, which was not just Sally and I, but in fact the whole of the ACTU executive, drew a line and said, this is unacceptable. We will not stand by and see a union that's been infiltrated by people whose interest was themselves. Look, I mean, I think we made the decision at the time that we had the information, and we acted fast, we acted decisively. We'd previously stood up and called out behaviour in the union that was unacceptable in terms of leaders and their domestic violence record. It is, I think, clear that we knew that what was right for working people is that there was no place for anything to do with violence and corruption in our union movement, and we acted on it.
And that is the ACTU president, Michelle O'Neill, speaking to us just hours after announcing her resignation, along with Secretary Sally McManus, from the Australian Council of Trade Unions. So One Nation leader Pauline Hanson has lost an appeal against a court ruling which found she'd racially discriminated against Greens Senator Maureen Faruqi. The decision dates back to 2024, and it found that Senator Hanson had breached Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act for a social media message that said, in part, that Senator Faruqi should, quote, and apologies for repeating this here, piss off back to Pakistan. Three federal court judges yesterday ruled that none of Senator Hanson's grounds for appeal had been established. Senator Hanson says she's reviewing the decision and flagged a possible high court challenge. Maureen Faruqi is a senator for New South Wales. She's a Greens spokesperson for tertiary education, emergency management and international aid, also for anti-racism. And she came on this morning with Sally Sara to talk about the court's decision.
Were you always confident that the ruling would stand?
It's hard to always be confident about what a court will rule, but we were very confident that what Senator Hanson had said was racism. And yesterday, the full court of the federal court has dismissed Senator Hanson's appeal against the decision of the primary judge and has reconfirmed again that 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act is a valid law of the Commonwealth, that Senator Hanson breached the law when she told me to piss off back to Pakistan, which is a racist, anti-migrant, anti-Muslim, and Islamophobic message. So it was a good day yesterday for people of color, for Muslims, and for migrants in this country. And, you know, this is a win. And I have always said that this case was taken to court on behalf of everyone who has been told to go back to where you came from. It was to court on behalf of every person who has been made to feel that their belonging to this country is conditional, and was taken to court for every person who has been told to sit down, to shut up, and to just be grateful.
The judges said yesterday that the original ruling was sound and agreed that Senator Hanson's tweet targeted, quote, immigrants, people of colour, and Muslims. That kind of phrase of go back to where you came from, with various other versions of it, how long-standing is that, and how widespread is that kind of expression now?
Well, people that I speak to every single day have told me how much this case meant to them, because they've spent their whole lives listening to go back to where you came from. And Justice Stewart, in his original ruling, found that telling someone to go back to where they came from is an age-old racist trope. And, you know, it is a strong form of racism. It is a statement that undermines people's sense of belonging and treats them as a second-class citizen. And it has a massive impact. This racism doesn't just happen in a vacuum. It has a massive impact on people who are targeted by it. And there are too many in this country who face racism every day.
A decision on costs has been reserved. Should Pauline Hanson pay the full costs of this case, in your view?
Of course, Senator Hanson should comply with the court orders and pay the full cost.
How prepared are you for the prospect that this may go to the High Court?
Senator Hanson is welcome, and it's her decision to take it to the High Court. If it does go to the High Court, we will be prepared. But I think, you know, Senator Hanson has twice already, by the federal court and then the full court of the federal court, been shown to have breached the Racial Discrimination Act. And it has been, now the court has decided twice that was racist. And so if Senator Hanson wants to be proved to be racist a third time, she's very welcome to do that.
Why do you think One Nation's political message at the moment has found seemingly such strong support in the community, which has been reflected in numerous opinion polls? One Nation has up to three times as much support as the Greens in some of these polls. Does that message show that, do those numbers show that their message is resonating more strongly than the Greens' message?
Well, one thing, if we could go back to the court case, one thing about the victory yesterday is that it was especially important for all of us, because it comes at a time when the far right is fueling rampant racism, and so many of us are feeling fearful as fingers are pointed at migrants and Muslims, and we are demonized. But this court case tells us that we can take on the racists and the bigots and those who would rather see us divided and united, and we can win. So I think that's the significance of the court case at this point in time. But going back to the rise of One Nation, it's pretty clear that the rise of One Nation is far from organic. It's not an accident. It's a billionaire, One Nation are billionaire-funded grifters that serve corporate interests while pretending to fight for ordinary people. And that is an ultimate game of distraction. But we also have to understand that the two major parties, Labour and Liberals, have created the conditions for One Nation to swoop in and to exploit people's insecurities and suffering. Because people are struggling, and no government is making their lives easier or better.
Maureen Faruqi there, a Green Senator for New South Wales, talking about this appeal that One Nation leader Pauline Hanson has lost, which found she racially discriminated against, Maureen Faruqi. Well, thank you so much for listening to all of those interviews from the Radio National Breakfast team and Sally Sara. The Breakfast Wrap was today produced by Eddie Diamond, and I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. We'll be back in your ears, same time, same place, tomorrow.